The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Lyle Himbaugh, he is co-founder at Granite Group Advisors. They're an independent wealth management firm, and he joins us on the phone on this Black Friday. Lyle, hey, good to have you here with Paul and myself. So it's been quite a year. I'm looking forward to wrapping it up, but I'm a little cautious and concerned about what 2023 brings. How do you see it?
Well, thanks for having me, and happy tryptophan overload day. I think, you know, right now, the way we're looking at the market, you know, the market, just to give you some context, the market historically trades at 15 to 16 times forward numbers. Right now, the market, you know, I'm referring to the S&P, we're trading around almost 17 and a half times forward numbers, and which is not really terribly expensive. But when you overlay the backdrop of, you know, a potential slowdown or even a recession. We don't believe we're going to go to a recession. We think we're just going to slow down a bit. You know, spending's pretty strong. But what really concerns me is, you know, the personal savings rate as a percentage of disposable income is right where it was back in 08. And we all knew what happened after that, right, from 08 to 09.
Right.
So I'm a little concerned. I mean, if I'm a short-term trader investor, I would be very cautious here. I would not put on new positions. If you have your gigantic profits in Apple that you've held for 10 years, great, keep going. I wouldn't buy too much. I'd wait for the market to present an opportunity to get a better entry point.
So, I mean, Lyle, we're up about 12% off of the recent lows in the S&P 500. That feels kind of real to me, or am I getting a head fake here?
No, that, it's real, but I just think, you know, people have, you know, there's a lot of hope built in this market that the Fed's going to slow the rate increase, and they're going to, but you have to understand the Fed is data-driven, and they can't get all the data until January for the fourth quarter. So they're going to raise rates again. You know, I would, you know, I think investors need to take a real hard listen to what Mr. Powell says, and he's raising rates. Is it 50? It's 75? It's still a raise, and he's probably going to raise again in the future. It's just going to be a slower rate. So I think there's a lot of expectation built in that it's going to really slow or stop. And you know, right now, I don't see it. But then you have that market valuation on top of that. So there's not a real lot. I don't see a big catalyst for the markets to go up here in the short term.
Well, what do you make, though, when, as you said, the Fed is data-driven, no doubt about it. Great story from the Wall Street Journal today, how the Fed's going to be watching Black Friday, Cyber Monday for insights into the health of the U.S. consumer. Wall Street Journal putting it this way, the diagnosis this year takes on increased significance in light of the deteriorating economic landscape. We know how important the consumer is to the U.S. economy. So if we see some sobering consumer spending numbers, might that change your thought about maybe when the Fed is done?
Absolutely. Listen, 70% of GDP is retail sales, right? So that's why they have to look at that. So when you take that into consideration, if we have a tough retail sales numbers come out after this weekend, I think the Fed's going to really keep going. They haven't really said anything different. They say they're going to keep going. So I think he'll just.
But you know what? I was thinking about this, Paul, coming in, which is pretty sobering since I was half awake. And this is what I was thinking about. But Fed policy, that if they do smaller increments, that leaves the door open that they might not go to that higher mm-hmm. Fed funds rate. They might see data points that say, we don't have to go as high as we thought. And it could change the thinking in terms of valuations.
Well, that would absolutely change the thinking. But as of today, you know, or yeah. Maybe we'll find out on Monday, that thinking hasn't changed. So I'm not going to be one of those, you know, hoping pray for, you know, the Powell to change his mind, right? So you've got to listen to what the man is saying, right? And he's not going to get all the data he really needs to make a really informed decision until really January.
Lyle, you've got a call on Mickey Mouse, the Walt Disney Company. They made a CEO change, shocking change in the CEO. What's your call on the Walt Disney Company?
You know, I think Disney is a great company for the long term. It's one of the few stocks I follow intimately. But I think, you know, Disney is fairly valued. I do think there's some upside there. I think that Mr. Iger, I always called him Mr. Positivity. Mm-hmm. He is an absolute phenomenal leader. Bob Chapek was clearly not the right guy here at this moment in time. I mean, we'll see what happens down the road. But Iger is going to do a great job. But here's the reality is, as great as Iger is, it's going to take some time for him to, you know, turn the battleship around. It's not going to happen overnight. He will turn it around. It's just a matter of time. Right now, the valuation on Disney is fair. Can it go up to 110, 120? Absolutely. I think it eventually gets there. They've got the world's largest library. They've got, you know ESPN and all the other ABC and everything else in there, and Disney Plus. It's just going to take some time. I would not be a seller here. And in fact, if we have any type of pullback, I'd be a pretty strong buyer of it.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Listen, thank you so much. Disney shares, by the way, they're down 36% so far here in 2022. Lyle Himbaugh, partner at Granite Group Advisors, is joining us on the phone.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You might recall a Bloomberg story last month. It was a pretty big deal, and I think she and I, our next guest, we talked about this, and I think even Paul, you might have been there. It was about University of Pennsylvania's Wharton announcing its 2023 MBA class was the first in the program's 140-year history to be majority female, because you just don't see that happen. So let's see what Alyssa Sangster has to say. She is CEO at Forte Foundation. She joins us on the phone on this Friday. Alyssa, nice to have you here with Paul and myself. Tell us and remind our audience exactly what you guys do at Forte.
Sure. Hi, Carol. Hi, Paul. It's nice to be with you. And we are celebrating 20 years this year, Forte Foundation is, and our goal is to increase opportunities for women in business leadership. And we partner with top business schools like the Wharton School, among many others. And this year we were really excited to see that number. And then also that about 17 of our member schools had reached 45% or greater, which is also a really significant milestone. And we've been following this trend for the 20 years we've been working.
So Alyssa, I see you got your undergraduate degree from Texas A&M and proud Aggie, and then the MBA from the Lowry Mays School of Business. And I know Lowry very well from Clear Channel Communications. Great, great individual. When you see women going into an MBA program, what are they looking to do? Is it a career change? Is it just, I want to better myself? And from a career perspective, what do most women look for when they go into a business program?
Sure. And MBA students generally are career changers, especially in full-time programs. And so when they make that commitment to go back, they really are looking for a different type of opportunity. And so women, much like men and women going back to MBA programs, are also doing that. But what we see on the backside of that is that women report higher levels of confidence. They feel like they're specialists in particular areas. They're able to walk back out into the workforce and feel empowered and respected for the degree that they have and for the knowledge that they bring to the table. So it really does build that confidence and set them on that trajectory towards leadership. And leadership is really where the MBA pathway takes you.
Alyssa, it sounds like I'm going to like poke Paul a little bit. So it sounds like men and women both go to get an MBA for the same reason. But I do wonder, a man having an MBA versus a woman having an MBA, what's the difference? Does truly an MBA give a woman a huge leg up when it comes to climbing the corporate ladder?
Well, about 6.6% of CEOs are women, and of that 6.6%, 42% of them have an MBA. That statistic is a little bit stronger for the men. So if you look at all of the other CEOs, it's, you know, closer to 50%. So it's clearly a very significant pathway leading to that C-suite. The difference between men and women is that when women get that MBA, it almost levels the playing field versus giving them a leg up. And so where you see women walking into a room to talk about business with other men, if they don't have that MBA, their confidence level can sometimes not be as strong, and then they're not feeling like they are contributing it the same way. So I think it's more of a leveling the playing field than it is necessarily giving them a leg up.
And Alyssa, I serve on the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University on their Board of Visitors, and it's, yes. It seems that at Duke there's a real focus on attracting a diverse class into their business school. Is that typical of some of the leading schools out there, do you find?
Yes, I think that the schools we work with, you know, gender equity has been very much a focus, but at the same time, they are very interested in the intersection of race and gender and making sure that that their student body is diverse. We do a lot of work around female protagonists in case studies. They're looking at how they teach the students, how many faculty members are diverse. They're trying to create a diverse student profile, but they're also looking at many other dimensions and how they deliver business education. And that's because companies want that as well. And the companies are saying to the business schools, we want diversity in our pipeline, and we need your help and your partnership to create that diverse pipeline. So schools and businesses hand in hand.
Alyssa, and forgive my sarcasm, but I do feel like I had this conversation 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I know it sometimes gets better, and all of a sudden we see more women who are CEOs, and then those numbers dwindle. So I get building out the pipeline, but what is the real problem in terms of more women penetrating really the C-suite, if you will?
Yeah, I think I wish I had a silver bullet. It really has been this layered onion approach more that we've seen. And, you know, the pipeline, getting more as many women in business school as there were in law and medicine, I think that's healthy. I think, though, when companies bring and onboard these classes of employees, they've got to really think about monitoring and watching and closely investing in all populations and making sure they have the same access and they have the same mentors and sponsors. And so that's hard work. I mean, that's every single day you have to be thinking intentionally about how you're advancing employees into these leadership ranks. And if you're not doing it carefully, and if you're not monitoring it and looking at metrics and making sure that you push those metrics, then you're not going to see success. And it really is about access and opportunity, because you can't go to the C-suite if somebody hasn't pulled you forward into those leadership ranks. So it's hard work, and there's always something more to be done. But I am encouraged, because when I started, there were zero CEOs. Now there's at least close to 7% women CEOs.
So. Hey, Alyssa, how did this all play out during the pandemic? Were there any meaningful changes in the trends of women in MBA programs?
No, I mean, I think the enrollment in MBA programs is watches the markets, and it goes when economy is strong, you see more students staying in the economy. And when the economy weakens a little bit, you see more students going back to get their MBA. Women held their own. They really stayed consistent in terms of their percentages. I think in MBA enrollments have dipped a little bit this year. But over the pandemic, they were quite strong. And so we're seeing though women are retaining that percentage that they've always had.
All right. I think we're going to leave it at that.
Yeah.
Really appreciate your time. Alyssa, thank you so much. Have a great holiday season. Alyssa Sangster, she's CEO at Forte Foundation, joining us on this Friday.
I may drive past the Short Hills Mall tonight, but that's about as close as I'm going to get.
You're not going to stop?
It's a full contact sport in the parking lot there, man. You have to be really aggressive to get a spot. I guess that's a good thing for the retailers.
Do they have valet parking at Short
They do,
Hills?
But I don't do that. Okay. I'm a man of the people here. Poonam Goyal, she covers all that retail stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's been doing that for a long time. She's seen her share of Black Fridays. Where are you now in the great state of New Jersey, Poonam? What are you seeing?
I am on my way to Dick's Sporting Goods. It's crowded. You know, we have analysts out on the West Coast in Massachusetts, in Chicago. It is crowded, and it is only getting more crowded. It's not slowing down. I mean, you know, we came into the season thinking that sales would be a little muted. If this day is proof of anything, it's that people are spending.
I got to tell you, Poonam, I like to do Twitter polls, and I said, are you shopping at stores this Black Friday? It's been out there for about 3 hours, this poll. 16% say yes, they're out shopping at stores. 64% said no. 20% said yes, but they're shopping online today. So I don't know. Maybe my poll is just people are just sitting at home listening to us, so that's why they're not out shopping. But it sounds like you and your team are really surprised by the people coming back to the stores, and the lines are there too, right? So that means they're not only just looking at stuff, they're buying.
Yeah, no, the polls are the polls, but as I said earlier, it's really the younger generation. I mean, it is the teens, the teenagers, the millennials. They are who are in the stores. So depending on who took that poll, but they're spending. There's lots of shopping bags floating around. It's busy, and it's just getting busier.
Poonam, we were just talking to Danielle DiMartino Booth. She's the CEO and chief strategist at Quill Intelligence, and she was just pointing out that the consumer's not as strong as maybe we think. The consumer has drawn down savings. Credit card debt is going up. What do the retail companies say about the health of the consumer?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I mean, retailers have been concerned for some time that consumers are going to be pinched, and that's why they're bargain hunting and deal hunting, which is maybe why it's so busy today, right? Because somewhere in their minds, they know that the best deals are going to occur this weekend. So if they want to save money, if they want to get maximize what's in their wallet, they need to be out today. They need to be buying over this weekend.
Yeah, I was thinking about, it's funny, I was just looking at Visa, and I'm going to be interested to see what Visa, MasterCard, all of those folks have
to
say.
Sorry, did I lose you?
No, are you still there, Poonam? Nope, maybe we lost her. She's dropped, yeah.
Okay, well, she's in route.
She's out and about, and she's checking out. She said Dick's Sporting Goods, yep. Which I do think, like, when it comes to shopping around the holidays, sometimes those specialty stores, like, people have very specific things on their wish lists, and they tend to do well. I feel like, you know, whether it's electronics, whether it's sports, whether it's, you know, kind of different items like this.
Yeah, I was interested. I am going to be interested to see how this all plays out in terms of the retail sales, because you come out of the pandemic, and it's all about experiences, traveling, you know, that kind of thing. But the consumer's still out there and strengthened. Poonam, we got you back. Thanks so much for joining us again. So when you think about a small segment of retail like sporting goods, what do you look for? What do analysts look for when they go to a sporting goods store and trying to get a channel check?
I think it's really the inventory levels, right? So when you see the shelves, how high are they stocked? Are they picked through? Are consumers gravitating towards one brand versus another? And then looking across the brand, right? Is Nike more on sale than Adidas? Is Puma more discounted? What are consumers picking after? Those are kind of the things that we look for.
Dick's Sporting Goods, guys, from about mid-June, it is up almost 70%.
Really?
So it has had quite a run and quite a rally. Is there something to it? You know, we were talking, Paul and myself, Poonam, just this whole idea that when it comes to holidays, you know, when it's something very special or a specialty store, I feel like those are the things that tend to show up on wish lists. And I wonder if that's the case when you look at retail and what tends to do better. Is it those firms and those companies and those retailers that have something very special and unique to offer?
Yeah, I think it's value or it's something very special. And very special, the only name that comes to mind really is Etsy. I think that's where Etsy's been thriving all year, and they will continue to, because they truly offer differentiated products, customized and more personalized products.
Hey, Poonam, when we talk to retail experts like yourself, you know, a topic that comes up is kind of the U.S. being overstored. There's still too many stores for the demand out there, but this is an issue we've been talking about for years and years. Where are we now in terms of the industry and its retail footprint?
I think there still are too many stores, and I think you will continue to see store consolidation. But then there are stores that need to expand too, right? Whether it's the off-price retailers or some of the grocers, or some of the international retailers, they're trying to gain presence here, whether it's like a Primark, which is a value-oriented retailer, or some of the brands that are just looking to open up some retail outlets. But they're all looking in the same space. They're all looking at the area. So you know, the Short Hills Mall and malls like the Garden State Plaza, it's hard to still find real estate there because that's where people want to be.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking at Etsy too. Like there, I guess it was like around mid-June that a lot of retailers kind of bottomed out, or at least a recent bottom. It is up 74% since mid-June. Like, wow. That is pretty remarkable. I was thinking about so many stories, Poonam, coming into Black Friday that we said, you know, maybe tempered demand, maybe it's not going to be as optimism. Are you getting ready to kind of rethink your research based on what you're seeing and what you're hearing from the team?
What we see today is that if Black Friday is back in motion, people are shopping, people are spending. It doesn't look muted to me by any means, but it, you know, there's a lot of holiday shopping still to go. This weekend is just the beginning. So if everyone has shopped this weekend and they don't go back out over the next 3 weeks, then holiday sales could still come in at the estimates that we've seen around, which are normalized to be 4-8% growth. So it really, the beginning is off to a great start,
yeah.
But we need to see if that momentum continues for the next 3 weeks, because the bulk of holiday shopping still lies ahead of us.
Especially as bills start to come in. It's like, we've spent all that we needed to.
Hey, Poonam, I'm not sure if you've spoken to your counterpart in London, Charles Allen, who covers retail for Bloomberg Intelligence. What's the expectation for our good friends over there in England, or maybe just Europe broadly defined?
I have not spoken to my London counterparts. I have spoken to people on the West Coast, and they're seeing the same trend. We have an analyst out in the malls there, and it's busy. It's the same stores that are seeing the traffic.
Where do you go from here? You've been so great talking to us at the top of each hour. You know, you started off at the Freehold Mall. You went to Kohl's. You're off to Dick's. Where else are you going to go check out today?
So there's another smaller mall, and I do want to go check out the off-price retailers, which aren't Black Friday destinations, but they do offer a lot of value, to see if traffic picks up. It usually picks up later in the day there at the TJX's of the world. But and then maybe take another trip back to the mall to see, does it get busier, or is it just, you know, through 3, 4 o'clock, and then the mall's kind of normalized too.
All right. Well, maybe I'll go out, and if you want, I'll go to Short Hills Mall for you and report back. But you'd have to pay me a lot.
He's only going to drive by. He's already said it.
Yeah, I think I might just drive by, and I'll take a picture of the parking lot and send it to you. Danielle, sorry about it. Poonam Goyal, thanks so much for joining us again at the top of the hour, giving us the latest on what's going on Black Friday. And Poonam Goyal covers all that retail stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So it just seems like every Fed president speaks all the time. Has that always been the case? It just seems like more and more, every time we turn around when they're not in the quiet period, we're hearing from a Fed
It's the norm nowadays,
I guess it's
right?
The norm, yeah. The only person I care about is Jay Powell, and I guess we're going to hear from him next week. And so when I want to get a sense on what's going on at the Fed and on the economy writ large, we turn to Danielle DiMartino Booth. She's the CEO and chief strategist at Quill Intelligence, former advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. She's our go-to voice on this stuff. So, Danielle, what is my Fed chairman going to tell me next week?
I think your Fed chair, come Wednesday, is going to be resolute, even though reading through those minutes on Wednesday, it revealed that he is increasingly alone in standing up against the doves. By the way, it is Friday, so I've got some people have the clock running down to New Year's Eve. I've got the clock running down to blackout, which is 7 days from now, which is when those Fed officials finally stop talking.
No, that's a really good point. And it did feel like the minutes, you know, even though they were a few weeks old at this point, there was something almost for everyone, Danielle, in that maybe we'll see smaller increases by the FOMC, but still we're talking about a higher ultimate Fed funds rate. So it did feel like there was something for everyone. What could Jay Powell say when he addresses the Brookings Institution in Washington on Wednesday? He's going to talk economy. He's going to talk about the labor market. He's going to take audience questions, brave man. What could he say that could change the thinking about Fed policy?
I think as long as Jay Powell sticks to his narrative that, you know, going from 75 to 50 is still unusually large, right? We didn't have 50 until 1994. Before this, so we're still at twice the magnitude, and that he sees nothing on the immediate horizon that suggests that the Fed has achieved returning to 2%, meaning we're not accustomed to the Fed bringing the Fed funds rate up and keeping it there. And I think he's going to reemphasize his idea of until the job is done. And that is going to fly in the face of those who are expecting some kind of easing in the near term. I say near term, meaning 6 to 9 months. I think he's going to refute that idea.
So the bull case out there for risk assets, I guess, Danielle, is predicated to some degree that, hey, the Fed has already raised interest rates pretty substantially. And lo and behold, it's actually working. Whether you look at the housing market or maybe look at some of the commodity prices rolling over, that a pause is a reasonable thing. But you're suggesting that's not where our Fed chairman is?
It's not that he doesn't. Remember, he's a lawyer. He's not a PhD in economics. He follows the real-time data probably more closely than a PhD in economics who would follow only seasonally adjusted long data series. He knows what's happening in the market. But again, financial conditions remain very loose, historically speaking. And I think that is more of his target, is trying to flush out this whole speculative nature that we've had in the markets for the last 40 years. I've been maintaining he's got a grander plan. He's trying to put monetary policy making back in the hands of the people, the officials at the Federal Reserve, as opposed to the market making monetary policy on behalf of the Fed, the tail wagging the dog.
But it is hard to be fair, for the Fed, it feels like, Danielle, especially when you do, whether it's the pandemic that causes all of a sudden unprecedented stimulus to be out there. We constantly see when we run into trouble that it does feel like lawmakers in Washington are quick to kind of help out and lend a hand, and that changes kind of the liquidity story and does make it trickier for the Fed.
It does. To the point of some St. Louis Fed research, we injected 43.2% of GDP into the economy inside of 12 months. Compares to the entire New Deal era, 40.1% of GDP. It does make it more difficult, but we have to remember that they monetized every last penny of that. So the Fed played the role of enabler. By the way, I don't think you get that out of this next Congress. I don't think you get the same form of stimulus as there's a greater recognition of recession. 8 weeks ago, we had one state with rising unemployment, initial unemployment claims. As of the 19th, Wednesday's report, we have 29 states with rising initial state unemployment claims. That's a real shift.
That's kind of where I want to go, Danielle, because we're going to get a jobs number next week. But we got record low unemployment. We've been hearing from our retail analyst on the top of every hour here is out at the shopping malls. People are out there shopping. It seems like we've got a pretty strong consumer, judging, if nothing else, everybody's kind of got a job.
Well, but everybody doesn't kind of have a job. If jobless claims were down 48.9%, that was the best that it was, right? Down is good.
Yep.
Jobless claims down year over year nationwide as of September the 24th. As of the 19th, jobless claims were only down 2.0%. In other words, the time we get this next Thursday's print, jobless claims nationwide are going to be rising year over year. That's why I think high-income consumers in University of Michigan data are telling you that they expect the unemployment rate to rise, as opposed to that middle tier and the lowest tier. They don't see it coming yet.
So would you go as far as to say that Fed policy, it is working? We see it in the housing market, and I agree with you. That last weekly jobless print showed, that things are starting to slow down in the labor market. We still have a ways to go. And, we certainly saw in the FOMC minutes, too, Fed staff warning of a chance of recession in next year is now near 50%. So Fed policy is working.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, obviously, you see it most in interest rate sensitive sectors. But for heaven's sake, I was just telling a friend, we had a furniture manufacturer with 2,500 employees announced that they were closing, like shutting up shop.
Wow.
We're not talking about a young furniture manufacturer in Mississippi, 2,500 employees let go on Tuesday, period end. There will be ripple effects into the economy from this slamming the brakes on the housing market. It's not just going to be contained to mortgage lenders. It's going to have broader economic ramifications, and we're beginning to see that. I suspect we'll see a lull in layoff activity in the month of December, because who wants to lay people off right in front of the holidays?
Right.
And then we get January. and then we get January and it's going to hurt.
Hey, Danielle, you're in, when I think of one of the most vibrant markets in the United States, Dallas-Fort Worth area, that Metroplex down there, how's the economy down there?
Well, the economy down here is still relatively strong. If you look at the nation as a whole, Texas unemployment claims are still down 4%. So we're just on the cusp of starting to enter recession in Texas. It has certainly been delayed because of the mass migration here to these markets. But even here, you're seeing home builders put incentives out there, cut home prices, and not gain any traction. And that tells you something about, basically, if you follow the entrails of consumer confidence, there's now a recognition. And I think that that's what's critical, is nationwide people have recognized that we're going into recession. This isn't just a CEO survey. This is a broader recognition among the public. And that's a game changer. Whenever, in any cycle, whenever you get to that point of recognition, that's when things start to change.
Danielle, we heard from Lyle Himbaugh earlier of Granite Group Advisors, reminding us 70% of GDP is retail sales. So this is something obviously we're focused on today because of Black Friday. We've been talking with our Poonam Goyal of Bloomberg Intelligence out at the malls. They're busy. They're getting busier. People waiting for parking spots. Black Friday can be a great data point for the Federal Reserve in terms of whether or not consumers feel confident about shopping. At the same time, I think it was maybe the New York Fed that put out some data about, you know, Americans, consumers are adding more to their credit card. So how might the Fed take Black Friday, Cyber Monday data and kind of add it into their thinking about Fed policy?
Well, I think consumer confidence, in the way you describe it, really speaks to people's willingness to completely max out their credit cards. And the data that's not being followed as closely is that we're about 90% tapped out in terms of credit card lines.
Really?
So, and we've taken savings down to such a level on a nominal basis that there wasn't enough savings to spend what Americans spent last December in terms of burning through their savings. The willingness is a corollary, if you will, to financial conditions being easy. Many Americans have never lived through the double dip recession of the 1980s, and they don't know of a Fed that doesn't come in and rescue the economy very quickly, mm-hmm. and not let the pain be felt. And I think that's how many households and many investors are operating.
Danielle, we're going to get the JOLTS data next week, job openings, and it's still big number, it seems to me, more than 10 million. How do you interpret the JOLTS number, or do you just kind of toss it aside?
You know, I don't toss it aside. I allowed some Fed staff papers to allow me to toss it aside.
Okay.
If you net out Fed research, there's the irony, is that Powell is ignoring Fed research. If you net out job postings that are written specifically to poach existing employed individuals, so I want to get a good employee from my competition and hire them for more money. If you net those types of job postings out, according to Federal Research data, your job openings are basically flat. There was a little bump during COVID, but otherwise basically flat. Job openings for people who are unemployed. So there's a critical distinction to be made there.
It's a weird economy, I think, making sense of it and coming out of this pandemic, right? We haven't lived through this before. So what is the thing? I mean, Fed policy, monetary policy, never a sure thing. There isn't a playbook that says this is exactly what you have to do, Danielle. You know this better than most. So what is the tricky thing? What is the major risk factor right here at this point in time for Jay Powell and company?
So the way I liken it for Quill's clients is cycle compression. So the way that he brushed off the idea of lag when he was at the podium, as opposed to it being recognized and written into the statement by the Doves. And my greatest concern is that Fannie Mae did research that showed that on average, it takes 5 quarters for home price increases and home price declines to manifest in the consumer price inflation, in consumer price index. It's taking only half of that time. In other words, the magnitude of the Fed rate hiking cycle plus QT in the background is moving monetary policy into the real economy at twice the speed as what we've seen when it used to be Alan Greenspan, 17 rate hikes in a row, only 25 basis points at a time. So I think that that's what we have to pay attention to, is the rapidity with which lag is making its mark on the real economy.
Hey, Danielle, just 30 seconds left. What do you get asked the most right now by your clients? Hey, explain this to us.
What my clients want to know the most right now are, why are credit spreads as wide as they are, and what's going to break? And my stock answer is, you have to pay attention to other parts of the world. High yield in Europe is degrading at a much faster pace. The credit event will happen. But so far, because financial conditions remain easy, it's going to keep the Fed's pedal to the metal, so to speak. But credit remains on everybody's front mind.
It always does end in credit. Danielle, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend. Danielle DiMartino, Booth, CEO and Chief Strategist over at Quill Intelligence.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.